Thanks, everybody, for coming, and welcome to Externalities and Dualism with Jamie Stallman. For those of you who have not been able to read his biography, it is quite amazing for someone at such a, I'm going to say, tender age. He's working on his master's as a student at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York. Yeah, this guy came from Fargo, North Dakota, you know. He went to Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, with a double major in biology and religion. So that's where his ecology and environmentalism piece will connect to his Bonhoeffer. Much of Jamie's passion and joy in his field overlaps, and that's bringing the different perspectives together. So we are delighted to have him here at Holden Village. One thing that you need to know is that this presentation is being taped, and Jamie has given us permission to do so. So should you choose to participate in the discussion, because he would describe his sessions as a teaching conversation. So he hopes you will participate, but you will also be recorded. And we thank you for agreeing to participate in the recording of this session. Thank you.
All right. So, like Lori said, I would really appreciate it. This is, we're going to cover a lot today. And if anything's confusing, or if I'm unclear in what I'm saying, if some term is unfamiliar, please interrupt and ask a question or a clarification. If you think you know what it is, but you're still just like trying to grasp it, please let me know. So, externalities and dualisms are, in the environmental movement, pegged as two of the main root causes of climate change. Externalities is an economic term, and dualism is kind of a philosophical, theological term. So we're going to see how both of these play off of each other today, and we're going to start off with externalities. So externalities is predicated on it's an economic system, and one of the important terms here is economic efficiency, which the definition is up on the screen, and I suppose for the recording, a broad term that implies an economic state in which every resource is optimally allocated to serve each person in the best way while minimizing waste and inefficiency. When an economy is economically efficient, any changes made to assist one person wouldn't harm another. It should be wouldn't harm another. So this is not kind of efficiency when you're thinking about miles per gallon in your car or doing the most work the fastest. This is what they call, it's Pareto efficient. And so this is something that, this is that red line represents any action that is maximally efficient that doesn't hurt the other party. It's not necessarily clear in this graph, but you maximize the output in this graph while not harming another party. Pareto efficiency, or economic efficiency, says that anything you do, just anything at all, is not efficient if it harms even another individual. Which sets up, it's interesting, so it sounds like nothing is really efficient in our economic system, right? so that's what we're going to talk about today. And so what happens is you get things called externalities. That's when an economic system is not efficient. And so the externality that is most commonly talked about in climate change is kind of carbon externalities. And the carbon pricing and the externalities associated with carbon are not currently included in our economic system, which is why they're called externalities, is they're external to the system. So this is according to the Hamilton Project. It's a great 35-page article that talks about the social costs of carbon. Social cost is another term for an externality because it's a socialized rather than a privatized cost. So according to the Hamilton Project, the status quo is characterized by a tilted playing field where our energy prices are based on the visible costs that appear on utility bills and at the gas pump. So the stuff that you actually pay for is the privatized cost. That's your cost. It's individual cost. But the system does not mask, the system masks the cost of social costs arising from those energy choices, including shorter lives, higher health care expenses, a changing climate, and a weakened national security. As a result, we pay unnecessarily high costs for energy. Does that kind of make sense? When you pay for gas at the gas pump, that doesn't necessarily include the costs of you burning that gasoline that puts the carbon dioxide in the air, the nitrous oxide that goes into the air that becomes acid rain in the Northeast. Those are externalities. So you don't pay for those. You kind of inadvertently pay for those through other systems like taxes, which comes in a little bit later.
So Jamie, when gas prices go up, cars get smaller and more efficient. And when gas prices go down, we get the guzzlers.
Yeah. So that's a good example of what we're going to get into.
Okay.
Is when you kind of mess with the market, you can then decrease those externalities. So we're going to watch this little clip that I think does a great job. It's actually lower ratings. Explaining how you can kind of mess with the market.
If both parties perceive that they're better off, sometimes these exchanges result in spillovers. We call these spillovers externalities. If the spillover is beneficial, we call these positive externalities. If they're costly, we call them negative externalities. Let's talk about negative externalities for a minute. Imagine being a corn farmer and growing corn. What are the private costs that you face to help you determine how many ears of corn to grow? Things like fuel, seed, fertilizer. These are your private costs. But it turns out that every spring and summer, when you lay down the fertilizer, some of it flows into a stream nearby and flows into a lake downstream, oftentimes resulting in large fish tanks. All those downstream, the fishermen, the recreationists, and the landowners, all incur a negative externality. There are three broad categories of ways in which we can address these externalities. The first is taxation. The second, regulation. And the third is by using property rights and the code theory. Let's talk about these individually.
So those are the three ways that we can kind of manipulate the market using either government, which are the first two, which we'll talk about, or still government, but making property rights very explicitly clear, which is where the Coase theorem comes in. It's this economic system that kind of uses a different kind of paradigm, for better or for worse, we're going to talk about where they break down, that allows for a different kind of looking at how we might solve problems. So instead of slapping a tax on something, and we'll talk about those problems, or just saying you can only emit so much, which is another kind of the regulation. The Coase theorem aims to make property rights explicitly clear. And he's going to explain a little bit about that, because it's really complex. And no, there's actually not one view of how the Coase theorem kind of plays out, because it's actually kind of difficult. But I think he did a good job.
Or better than I. Economist A.C. Pigou first suggested that we can impose a tax on the producer that would reduce the amount of production of whatever good is that's producing the negative externality. The benefit of this, of course, is that you would reduce the amount of negative externality you impose downstream. However, the difficulty is monitoring. It's difficult to know exactly how much fertilizer is being laid out in our example, or how much pollution is being emitted from various point sources. And so the monitoring costs are quite high. The second way that we can address externalities is through regulation. There are many examples. Let me name two. One is through technology-specific methods. This is where the government requires producers to use a certain technology to reduce pollution or emissions. The benefit is that monitoring costs are quite low. You don't need to have somebody out there constantly monitoring the amount of emissions because you know that technology is present and working. The downside is that it reduces the incentive for firms to find innovative ways to further reduce their emissions. The second of these regulatory methods is by simply restricting the quantities produced, either of the output or the pollution being produced through production. The benefit is, of course, is that now firms have reason to find innovative ways to reduce the pollution. The difficulty is that the monitoring costs are quite high. The third broad way to address externalities is the property rights solution, suggested by economist Ronald Coase. He said, if property is well-defined, divisible and defendable, and negotiation costs or transaction costs are low, simply by assigning the property right, we can overcome the externality. Well-defined, divisible, and defendable. These are the three characteristics that you must have in order to have a fully functioning property rights solution.
That kind of sink in just for a second?
Nope, I didn't get that one at all. That's
so
the other two.
I think what we're going to do is just kind of bop back between. We're going to hear the explanation again, talk about regulations, hear the explanation again, talk about taxation, and then hear this third property rights again and talk a little bit about how it's a different system.
Okay.
That makes sense? Okay. So we're going to go through it again. And and slowly interpret about it instead of just me have me lecture about it. So just that's funny.
Well defined. What is the object over which the owner has rights? In what manner may this owner exercise his or her rights? Divisible. Are these rights separable? And can they be trained? Defendable. Are these rights enforceable? Are these rights recognized either by a custom, by the community, or a third government entity? Let's go back to our example. Let's assign the property rights of the lake to the farmer. You may first imagine that the farmer doesn't change his or her behavior. However, now, the fishermen and recreationists downstream can negotiate with the farmer to reduce the amount of fertilizer that he or she lays on the field. This reduces the amount of fish death downstream. We could also, conversely, assign the property rights to the fishermen, who you may initially think would require the farmer to stop using fertilizer on the land. However, now, the farmer has the incentive and the knowledge to negotiate with the fishermen downstream. The fishermen will allow some positive amount of fertilizer, but not as much as before. In each scenario, we come to a solution that internalizes the externality, or overcomes it. The fishermen and the farmer now know the cost of the externality, and are able to negotiate in order to overcome it. The benefit of this to other regulations is that the monitoring costs are very small. Not only that, there's incentive for either the farmer or the fisherman to find ways to reduce the negative impact on social welfare. CoSteer overcomes these monitoring costs by using local information.
We're going to care less about the monitoring costs. It makes it really messy.
Yeah.
So instead, we're just going to focus just quickly on, well, not quickly, this is integral to what I'm talking about, is externalities. So to kind of make sense what an externality is,
mm-hmm.
What other externalities can you think of?
Mercury gets into fish when coal is burned.
Yep.
They just passed legislation in Minnesota where instead of controlling the fertilizer, they're trying to control the drainage. It was a compromise externality.
Mm-hmm.
And then it didn't go as far as some people wanted it to go. But because they put in all this tile drainage, so much of the fertilizer was washing on down into the rivers. So they're making them put in strips of land, fallow or other planting that isn't harvested, that there should be less drain on. So would that fit into the same thing? It would just be, rather than taxation, it would be a land use requirement. It would be another way, of doing some of that external stuff.
Yeah, so that's... Well, the externality would be the runoff going into the Gulf.
Okay.
Would be the actual, the dead zone that is really to deal with that. And then the fishers and the tourists and also the tourism industry in the Gulf Coast would be affected by those externalities. But the example that you talked about of taking the tile out
or controlling
the drainage a little bit more is a good example of how these Coase theorem talking about the low transaction costs. Minnesota has like a really good conversation about the farm bill. And so that's really easy to talk about it. And so you have these farmers coming, well, it's easier than like in North Dakota. I'm from North Dakota, it's a mess. We don't ever want to talk about it. And they're actually putting tiling in North Dakota. And they're taking it out of Iowa because of these kinds of problems. So you have low transaction costs and these property rights are really clear about the river being a public good, or these externalities are a problem that we need to have a negotiation between these two parties to get something solved, rather than slapping a tax or saying, stop putting, you can only put this much fertilizer downstream. Another example of an externality?
Carbon tax.
Well, so the carbon tax is the solution to the externality of carbon burning.
Cigarettes?
The externalities, what are the externalities associated with cigarettes?
So you buy a pack of cigarettes, but you don't buy whatever you emit into the air from smoking a cigarette?
Correct. So specifically, though, like secondhand smoke, that's an externality.
Yes. Cancer.
Yeah, so cancer is then kind of a socialized cost. Well, I mean, because you pay for most of it, but because of healthcare, we also, everyone else pays for it too, to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Also really depending on the plan you have, but
You need a war machine to continue to get oil from the world.
Yeah, that's a huge externality.
And we don't talk about it.
We don't.
It's the biggest one around.
Yeah.
Say again.
The American interest in the Middle East is something that we, it brings down the price of oil to $3 to $5 per gallon, but we're also paying for that war. So it's kind of the system internalizes the externality very differently. But if we were actually paying for the war, it's kind of like a war tax, if you would, or like interest tax in with the price per gallon, it would be significantly higher. And you'd probably push back on it because you wouldn't want to, or you'd actually buy less gasoline because it would cost so much. So that's an example of a tax that you might put on to actually reduce the amount of goods that you're producing to then lower the externalities.
Are externalities always things like that are have negative impact? Because could it be like water or air?
Yeah. So there are many positive externalities. There's sometimes in the environmental movement we focus on the negative externalities. When you put up a dam, there are many negative externalities, but a positive externality is that then tourism comes and you look at the Hoover Dam and it's this huge and brings a lot of money, and it wasn't necessarily an intended consequence of putting in the Hoover Dam. Or also the fishing that arises because of these reservoirs that come up. It's kind of a positive externality for the region.
I was just going to say, can you give us an example? I think I'm getting this, but using what's going on right here in Railroad Creek Valley with the mine and now the remediation and the use of diesel, etc.
So do you want to go through the different ways of how to change the market before we talk about that? Because that's a good example of regulation.
Okay.
That says, so we know what's the externality from mining here. What are a few externalities of what's going on and what happened with the copper, gold, and silver mine?
The tailings of the creek was poisoned.
Yeah. Huge externality that we feel, but when you buy an iPhone and you've never been to Holden, you don't feel the externality at all.
With the noise and...
Absolutely. Yeah, and actually noise pollution is a good example of where the coast theorem falls apart. It's because it's really hard to say who owns noise. Or everyone has kind of a different threshold for noise pollution. And so we kind of have to just suffer through it. But if your neighbor's having a rock party, then to some degree you might put up with it, or you also might not. And then you can negotiate with this person, but noise pollution is still hard to define property right.
That was kind of where my question was going. How does this address more qualitative type studies or personalization? Because it seems to have a strong economic sense of balancing. But even like with cigarettes, I just don't like being in a room full of cigarette smoke. And 30 years ago, I maybe wouldn't even notice it.
Yeah.
But so part of that is changing within my expectations. But does it measure these qualitative kind of aspects as well, or is it more looking at the economic aspects?
Well, so let's go back and listen to the Coase theorem just quickly.
Fully functioning property rights solution. Well defined. What is the object over which the owner has rights?
So, well defined is where some of these examples definitely fall apart. Where drainage is kind of, we've done a lot of studies, we know the drainage of a fertilizer into the Mississippi down the Gulf Coast is a bad thing. There are many externalities that we didn't originally intend, and people are benefiting from externalizing the costs onto others. But cigarette smoke and noise pollution are not well defined. They're different for everybody, and are examples of why the other two systems might work better in that example, which are regulation and a tax. And so we do get taxes on cigarettes. which has significantly decreased, as well as public education, but those taxes have significantly decreased how many people smoke. And same with the gas tax, is that it hasn't risen since like 1984 or whenever it was last, something crazy like that, has not risen for a long time. Does not accurately go with how much less gas we should be consuming because of the externalities that we know now. But it's because lobbyists don't want to include that into the current system, because then people would actually consume less gas. Yep.
So one of my concerns is we all have hundreds of toxic chemicals in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, bees are dying off all over the world. There's, again, probably two toxic chemicals, but for someone to do the research to figure out which chemical is maybe causing which disease and what's the threshold and how they all work together, is that research, who's going to pay for that research to be done? I mean, I don't see how we can apply this system to saying, I don't want any toxic chemicals in my body. I think there are some problems, proving what does what. And
certainly, yeah, we definitely live in a complex world, and it's hard to do cause and effect and say this specific chemical leads to this specific thing. One of the things that we do in environmental economics is actually ask that question: how much pollution is too much pollution, or how much chemical is too much chemical? And we can certainly have that discussion right now, if that might become interesting.
Well, a big side that's coming up lately is on the regulation side. That's back to economics. I can't do anything because I've got to go through 7 years of regulation preparation to allow me to do it. I mean, we even face that up here, working with the Forest Service and the state and the EPA, because I got to get all these regulations. And yet, how do you do it? That's only one way of trying to control that issue. But then when does it become too complex or too technical?
Well, I think that's a good example of where the monitoring costs are too high, that they actually become really inefficient, that another system might be a little bit more economically efficient, as well as just generally more efficient. And we can talk about these other types of regulations quick. Because that's just straight up regulation. That's kind of just saying you can only have this many emissions or whatever it is, and we need to make sure that you're only going to put that much into the environment before you get started.
So the premise of this discussion is about efficiency and the choices that we make being positive for everyone.
Correct.
And how, when that doesn't happen, this is the way that we deal with it?
Yep.
Okay.
So this, and along with that, is the premise of, it's an economic out of sight, out of mind. Is that most of the actions that we do, like anything, your iPhone, everything has some kind of externality. You're making some kind of value when you do something. When you buy organic food, you're making a value judgment. When you come to Olden Village, I mean, I drove here instead of flew, which both of those come with their externalities, but they're value things that, maybe since I'm a grad student, I have a little more time, but no money. then those are my kind of like value judgments at that point. But still, when you're like driving through the mountains near Missoula, I'm not thinking about, and I'm not trying to destroy the world. I'm trying to come to a place I love, and I'm looking at the mountains and just feeling like, thank God I'm not in New York right now. So these are the kinds of things that, the kinds of discussions that need to happen, but just aren't.
So it's like we're living, like we have stepped away from living in a way that's completely like eco, like every action that we're taking, we're removed from that now.
Yeah.
But then now there's all these negative consequences that are happening. And so how do we approach them?
Exactly.
And figure, okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so some systems like industrial agriculture have certainly led to, I have no idea where my food comes from anymore.
Right.
And that's why we're going for local food, is because you're connected and you're trying to diminish those externalities that living, growing, or going to school in Decorah, you know exactly where your farmer comes from, you know where your meat comes from, you know that they don't use antibiotics, you know they don't use any kind of fertilizer. It's just as organic and local as it gets, and there are hardly any externalities associated with those decisions. And so the paradigm right now is to internalize the externalities, because all these externalities are affecting, are also adversely affecting the people who can't try to take care of those externalities themselves. So like, an externality is that half of Pakistan was underwater a couple years ago, and because it was exacerbated by climate change, that we don't feel whatsoever.
Just still wrapping my head around all of this, would an example of internalizing an externality be asking people who have diamond rings to think about where that diamond comes from and do some research and go to a website and look up diamonds that aren't blood diamonds? And
that's a perfect example.
Oh, right.
Yes. So another kind of directly correlated with that is a carbon tax, saying we're actually going to charge the amount that we think is the negative externality amount on with what you actually emit. And so right now you can do carbon credits or carbon offsets, and that kind of is trying to internalize those externalities, but it's not quite there. Some people don't like them because they sound like indulgences, and they don't, there's hard to actually measure the correlation and causation and what that money goes to. So instead they're trying to say, let's do $15 per metric ton of carbon dioxide, CO2 equivalent. And so the average, and at least in 2003 when Al Gore wrote did his movie, the average American household was emitting 14,000 metric tons a year. And so you just, if the government put on a $15 per metric ton carbon tax, then you would be paying for all of that carbon that you put into the air. And that money would go into incentivizing, just a plethora of things. It would go into incentivizing to bring down carbon intensity. It could also go into programs that help people who can't help themselves emit less. Like there are differences between, this is a little bit of a tangent, but there are differences between luxury emissions and necessary emissions. I'm going to a conference in Switzerland, obviously a luxury emission that I'll then get some carbon offsets for. But some kinds of things like eating, those come with emissions, but the necessary emissions.
Congrats to, you don't need to eat.
No, exactly. I was going to sleep. I'll just keep
it. So now that I'm feeling just terribly guilty for, you know, whatever, where does this take us in terms of our individual responsibilities? I guess as I'm getting your drift here, mm-hmm. we are all responsible for our externalities and what we do about it. And are there some specific things that you're talking about, things that can make us do it?
Yeah.
But what do we do as people if what we're doing isn't taxed, if what we're doing isn't regulated?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing with my life. And I think that there are a lot of very creative solutions. So for example, Yale actually instituted on themselves a $20 per metric ton carbon tax. And so it's not the government, they put it on themselves to make sure that money, it stays within their system, so they reinvest it into LED light bulbs and higher, like better insulation, higher efficiency furnaces and air conditioning units, that then just dramatically brings down their carbon emissions. And then what they can't then take care of, then they buy carbon offsets with the tax that they put on themselves. Luther College actually thought about doing this a few years before Yale did, but it got shut down because it's part of that, why would you tax yourself, right? You know, you take your money out of your operating budget and put it into something else. It's not a very popular move. But it's an interesting solution.
So is the bottom line that individuals will only be accountable through regulation?
No, that's kind of what the Coase theorem is talking about. Is and it's a little bit more difficult when it comes to larger wicked problems like climate change, because it's hard for an individual to make property rights for clean air and clean water, and that's what kind of regulation has to be a part of it. But the clean air, the clean power plan, and I don't know what kind of support it has in Washington, is not very popular in North Dakota because we got hit really hard because 80% of our energy comes from coal. But a lot of the Northwest and Eastern states didn't get hit as hard because they're already using a bunch of renewable resources, especially offshore wind and here hydroelectric. So just, Travis looks like he has something to say. So one of the things that individuals can do is like show their support for that, saying that you realize that it's not the popular thing to do. It might be personally more expensive for you to do, but in this current system that we're working in, it is internalizing your externalities.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like the first step is to make the invisible visible.
Yes. And that's kind of, it's hard sometimes to make the invisible visible. And so when you go shopping, when you order on Amazon, it's just like two-day shipping, and it's just great, but you don't think about the carbon that comes with it, or the trees that had to be cut down to make the cardboard, or the packaging that comes with it.
Or the slaves that work for
the
Amazon.
The slave labor
that yeah, all these things, exactly. So it's kind of...
Or the airplane emissions, if they're flying it in from a long way away.
Yeah, it's... I don't know, sometimes I get confused because I think, you know, we do think in terms of the individual and what the individual can do, mm-hmm. but we also should think about the corporate world and corporations because they have a huge influence on our environment. And how do we bring those two things together? I would like to think that maybe the next revolution is to hold corporations accountable for what they do. Right now, many choose, you know, to ignore the regulations in order to make a greater profit.
Yeah, so with Rio Tinto, can pay the $500 million because that the tax wasn't high enough. If it wasn't enough, because it's essentially that's what it is, it's a tax, it's a fee, but it's the same kind of incentive structure, that it wasn't high enough for them to say, we're never going to do this again. But to some extent, they are also monitoring the next few projects because it was... at least high enough for them to put it on the radar.
Yeah, and I think about the fact that we're all connected. I mean, I think in a way we kind of disassociate. Like we can say, China, you're polluting the air, but it's actually the goods that we demand in our society.
Yeah.
We push the manufacturing offshore, so they do it, and now they're stuck with the pollution it's emitting in the world, but it's still part of us because we're asking for that.
Mm-hmm. That's another great example.
It's not a separate.
Yeah.
You know, we can't say, well, Chinese fix the air. Mm-hmm. Well, we're contributing to that. We're connected in that.
Yeah. And I think this is maybe what I was going through at Luther, is from an individual perspective, it can just be really overwhelming. Like, what can I do? I'm just one person in 7 billion. Nothing. It's insignificant, inconsequential. But this is, I think, maybe where Bonhoeffer is kind of pushing me, is that Bonhoeffer defines his theology, we're going to get into this later, not necessarily today, but his starting point is community. It's not the individual. It's saying that if the individual is subsumed by the community, and then all of a sudden you're not an individual, then that doesn't work. But if you're an individual living in community, that's how you do it. That's how you have this holding community that can then work together and be defined as a community to actually see these kinds of changes you'd like to see.
Well, and I think this is being driven even more intensely, and we may not even be aware of it because of this, some of the big isms, the globalism and technology. We have an imbalanced world, is who has the goodies and who doesn't, and who's got the money and who doesn't. And so if the rest of the world tries to, in some sense, equalize us, that's part of what China and India are doing right now, when you look at the total number of people. But, you know, as an example, 10 years ago, I couldn't get fresh blueberries in the winter, but I'm helping a lot of Chilean and other countries have industries they didn't have before by supporting that, although they have to fly them up on airplanes. So that complexity, which you're talking about, and on a real simple level, is there. Mm-hmm. But it's also macroeconomics, and where's the poor and the wealthy variation and the choices that, maybe not so much whether you're poor or wealthy, but the choices you may have.
Yep.
Because you're wealthy. And back to that earlier question I was trying to get at is, and we're not even talking about a lot of the qualitative differences.
No.
Or values of life choices. So it's almost scary enough to say, I can't do anything about it. I just don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can. And that's with Bonnie, it was, I think, what you're alluding
to. It's a good example of doing something as an individual, right? Yeah. And while still defining his theology as part of community.
Yeah.
And I think this is also a good example of where economic problems and economic solutions can kind of break down. That sometimes it is a values thing. That theoretically, capitalism says it's an expression of your self-interest is the best for the common good. But externalities show that it's not for the common good. It's for those who can afford to externalize those effects onto others. That's who the system is working for.
Or, on the other hand, it can also prevent us from knowing what are those externalities.
Exactly.
The example I get is, that comes to me is, and our government did this, they prohibited the investigation of gun violence by the National Institute of Health.
Yeah, exactly.
That's an externality that we don't want to know about.
Yeah.
Or apparently somebody doesn't want. Well, the gun industry doesn't want us to know about.
Yep.
And they've got the lobbyists, and they've got the NRA, mm-hmm. and they've got a lot of evil people, as far as I'm concerned, doing horrible things to us. As a community.
Mm-hmm. So I think that is also a good example of being outwardly curious, asking questions, and also just, you know, thinking about what are the externalities that I'm incurring in someone else, and what are the externalities that are happening to me too. Stuff like eating the mercury that's laden our fish, stuff like that. Travis?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like even the term externality is sometimes a little misleading, because although it is an externality, when you start thinking about how it's affecting you, yourself, I mean, mm-hmm. increased fire intensity across the entire West is not a coincidence. It's, you know, heavily tied to changing climate patterns that are associated with changing climate. And so thinking of that externality that you're in fact then putting on to yourself, it's almost like an internality or something. I don't know what's a better word to describe it, but it's... It changes the moral case from something that about others to also realizing that this is heavily taken down on myself.
Yeah, I think also with the externalities is that it's not, the true cost is not what you're paying for up front. And that's kind of what the externality is that when you are doing any activity that induces more climate change, you're paying for that up front, gasoline, electric, everything. And then you pay for the fire suppression on the back end. And it is uneven. That's the problem with externalities.
Let's say you came here for a week as an externalitologist to study how Holden creates or perpetuates externalities.
Mm-hmm.
What would be one externality, I'm gonna say it four more times, externality, that you would try to eradicate? Or is there anything glaring you see here and think, I wish we could rid it, hold him of this externality?
I'm going to have to think a little bit more on that.
I know one we've talked about.
Oh, yes.
One we've talked about is getting here.
Yeah.
I mean, just getting here is really hard.
Yes.
And many modes of transportation. So, we've even talked about if you're, you know, putting general carbon, you know, how much carbon are you using getting from wherever you're coming, and what could we do with that money, you know? So, getting here is one of them for sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure we have many more if we would make them visible.
Thank you. one of the problems, obviously, with our current system is that they're invisible, and that's the thing with externality. You have a question? Something?
Oh, I had a comment going back a number of minutes. You were saying it's hard to assign property rights to like clean air or noise or stuff. Mm-hmm. I did want to, there's one kind of hopeful thing I wanted to mention is that I live in Washington State, and there were, in the last couple of years, there were like 6 major new coal terminals proposed for various places along the coast, and my understanding is 5 of those have been denied the permits to go through, and it was based on the treaty rights for local, for indigenous tribes who, you know, I think made the argument, I think some of the arguments were there would be so much pollution that they would not be able to, you know, they have rights to fish and to have their traditional ways of living, and that those would, they wouldn't have those anymore if the terminals were put in. So I'm just saying, unfortunately, we don't have rights like that to clean water and clean air, but they kind of do.
Yeah.
And they've been, I think they've been effective in, I mean, to my great belief and joy, they've been effective in enforcing those.
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of it is, can you look, to your point, the guys that built the mine didn't pay attention to this because they didn't factor that into the cost and the profit of getting that copper ore out of here. And so they left that mess. Now, if we were in a more enlightened world, we would have said, no, part of the cost of getting that copper is to do it in a way that it doesn't impact other people. And so we don't do that very well as humans. I'm not sure if it's the greedy gene or it's just the not paying attention gene, but whichever set it is, we don't think through that stuff. In all kinds of levels, economic and personal, where we just do what we feel like.
We're going to get a little bit into that in just a second, too, in terms of the mentality that is associated with this.
I was going to raise the word capitalism as the name of the economic system that allows and encourages us to behave in these ways. We're from Canada. There are alternatives to capitalism.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the, but it's hard to think about them because our lives produce, you know, the standard of living we have is, we have, not everyone has, is produced by capitalism.
Can we just go back to just one thing about this coast theory?
Yeah.
That has been bugging me since the first time I saw it. So, the farmer is throwing money over to the fisherman, and the fisherman is throwing money over to the farmer, and they're all happy, and the fish have no money to throw anybody. And they're part of the result. So not only do we have to make visible the things that we don't know for ourselves, we probably need to make visible effects for those that cannot speak for themselves, whether it's fish or third world countries or air or water or
I'm gonna let you comment, and then that's a perfect transition into the dualisms that we're gonna get at.
Okay.
So that was just you. Perfect transition.
I'd like to pick up on that as well, because I'm a little surprised that, you know, I'm not sure where you're going over the full week, but in my retirement, at least as I contemplate these things, I've come to the conclusion that everything is spiritual and everything is linked to economy, that is to say, how I make a living and how I help you make a living. But as I look at that mural painting called Machuco, it reminds me of the Tree of Life. And it seems to me, in a lot of these economic theories and discussions about economic theories, we're talking about how the branches and the fruits and the this, that, and the other thing, but we're not talking about the roots. And to me, spirituality, Luther, scripture, faith is the starting point. And, you know, we have doctoral degrees, we know we've written dissertations, we know something about complexities, at least in our own areas. Mm-hmm. And some of us just love complexities, but, you know, Jesus did not talk in complexities. Love God completely. So when she's talking about the fish, that's a spiritual statement, because it's a statement that says, I'm not the only creature in this world. That comes from a faith statement. In the beginning, God. Right? You know, as in Genesis. And when you begin with, you know, sola fide, sola scriptura, when you begin with the right few steps and not suddenly hop up to the fruits, when you attend the fruits come of themselves. So if I'm supposed to love, I mean, as the scripture goes, and the words of Jesus, you know, I'm supposed to love God completely. In other words, the focus is out there. And secondly, my neighbor as myself. So from those first two steps of, okay, that's the story I base my life upon. What does that mean now to follow Jesus, to follow worship and to love neighbor as self? And I know that may seem kind of wacky to the corporate consumer world, because their story is, I'm a God. Life's about me. Screw you, screw the living earth. It's all object. I want money, geld, so I can worship myself, because, you know, that's just what I am. I'm a God. Ask Trump. Right? You know, ask all of us. It's better to have 50 pairs of shoes than one. We say Jesus is our master. Can't recall how many popes he had, but I think it was one. There is a sense of simplicity there, which we don't have. So do you get the idea of everything is linked to spirituality, which to me is why hope is so important. And when we talk about roots, first of all, as opposed to the fruits, we have a chance of, you know, kind of deconstructing this thing that we call life and economy and pollution and externalities. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it's getting into the second point of the dualisms. So a dualism is an example of something that is set over and against another thing that are seemingly different but are not necessarily different. So you get mind and body is the most common one. You get spirit and body too, soul body. Some these things that the notion that the soul ascends and the body stays here is that they're two different things. And that's, we're going to get a little bit of that theologically later, but I think we're going to start off with a little thought experiment to test how ingrained these dualisms are. So the thought experiment is kind of like a Freaky Friday. You've seen that movie kind of thing? So you've just died, but your brain is still kicking, and they can do this experimental operation that you can do a complete brain transplant into another body. Are you still you? I don't want you to think about that for a second. Or who is in that body now?
Depends on how you define you.
Well, that's part of it.
I think it breaks down. I mean, it is in the sense of, it's my thinking, it's my brain. It's my brain that's sending the signals to my hand to do this. But as I look in the mirror, it's not me. Mm-hmm. And from an external point of view, maybe internally, yes, but externally, my children would not know who I was. Because at least not in the beginning. Maybe after a period of time, oh, that's something that Dad would say.
Well, what about people who experience severe burns or have a ton of plastic surgery to look really, really different? They're still them. Mm-hmm. Aren't they?
No. Or I'm going to be not nearly as pretty in that other body as I am now, because what's made me is so complex in so many people, and if I think that's good, then it's going to be a bad exchange. But if I don't like all that stuff, all that's external, so that's the big issue with dualism.
Yeah.
What's true? Is it, am I one unified thing, or am I a combination of all these things? Mm-hmm. And how you come to block that each day contributes to the answer to the question.
I also think, well, with that, that's interesting, but the thing, I've experienced everything through my body, and so that's part of what shaped me, and so I don't know if those things can be separated necessarily. I think
somebody else's body.
Yeah, well, all of a sudden it would be weird, like part of, yeah, everything I've experienced and it's all come through this, mm-hmm. you know, so it would be a thing.
Yeah, I even think about muscle memory, talk about playing like an instrument.
And you're an artist?
There are things that my hands know that my brain doesn't know.
Yeah, how do we explain the phenomenon when there are organ transplants and there's that strong emotional connection to a mother whose child's heart or whatever has been given to another, and there is that strong pull toward that new being that was never known before, but now has the heart of my child.
But then you come back to the spiritual story we say we live by. You know, you're not your own. You were bought with a price. So glorify God with your body. Jesus calls us to die to ourselves, like a seed that goes in the ground. Take up your cross daily.
Well, I think, do you have any more thoughts about the thought experiment?
Or it's like the boat that gets worked on throughout the years. Like, you know, each part, you're like, every year you're doing a little remodel, and all of a sudden you look at the boat now, and you've actually remodeled every part of the boat. And no piece that was there to start is there anymore. Is it the same boat?
There was an excellent part on This American Life last week about a woman who was very obese and then lost 150 or 200 pounds. And she talked about the old self and the new self, and she really was conflicted in that, when that image had changed, and her internal view almost as two different people because of the way that everyone would react to the difference in looks. And tossing that out as a curiosity, I'm not sure what direction that leans things for, but it was very incredible to hear this 45 minutes of her talking about that process.
So through this little discussion, it sounds like the mind and the body are not two separate things, but it's a lot more complex than that. Right? So what other dualisms in our world can you think of that are perpetuated? Because even if this is kind of the thing with dualisms, is that we talk about not living them, and yet we still live them. They're so internalized, and so we're so steeped in them, because as Lynn White said in 1967, he published his thing in Science, and he gets bashed on this all the time, but he actually like published 2 years later some other stuff talking about, because he published this article that said it was Western Enlightenment that led to these kind of dualisms that came from the Greek Hellenistic thought, where you get Aristotle, the rational and irrational, the emotional and the logical. That's two different dualisms, and he does all the time. Like, for some reason, women are emotional and men are logical. And we know that not to be true, and yet we talk about it all the time.
Could I suggest that maybe male and female is a dualism?
Yeah.
Right and wrong.
Yeah.
Well, saint and sinner is we're caught with both of those identities. Once we're baptized, we're dualistic in a sense.
And all that
we have that inner struggle.
I think those maybe there's a difference between a dualism and the dialectic, is that the same and sinner has to be kind of always in oppositional parts, always together. But a dualism is something that a hierarchy arises because of this. So with the mind and the body, we get a lot of, in today's world, depending on what group you're in, you either get a lot of hedonistic tendencies and put a lot of weight into the body in this world and don't care about anything that has to do with the next world, or you put a lot of time and weight into what happens in the next world and don't care about this world. So that's the dualism that the environmental movement, and probably not as much here, but growing up in capitalistic North Dakota, this is something that I talk with people all the time about. They just don't realize that their eschatological framework about what it means to have the next life means that I don't have to care as much about this life. And those are the dualisms that are perpetuated and are very common in this culture.
So we had a Secretary of Interior who believed that the world was going to end. And because the world was going to end at any time in the next 50 years, we didn't have to worry about the water, the air, because it's not going to be our problem, because God's going to come in and make it all right. And that's just an excuse not to do anything. And so I can make more money.
Right. Yeah.
There you go.
So are there other dualisms that we can think of? Mind, body, rational, emotional.
Well, how about us and nature, as if they're two different things?
That's exactly what Craig was getting at.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, the hierarchy there is just so easy to see, but it's so internalized. This is not something that Rio Tinto can still go out there, and they see a tree, and they just need to move it because something needs to go there. Mm-hmm. And it's just not, you just don't even think about it. You're just going to chop that tree down. And this is not just Rio Tinto's problem either, but...
Well, it can be, in a sense, we do it. I personally like most of the people that work for Rio Tinto that I have contact with.
Yeah.
Nice, have good conversations, but I don't like their company and who they work for and their policy, I think it's, and there's a dualism that I'm willing to, I wish Rio Tinto did things different throughout the whole world. I wish that these people who I've become at least friendly with, could make the change with that company. But I do like them.
Yeah. The foundation there is that environmentalism is not being above, it's not being a nice person. It's not what it's about. It's a values thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I meet nice people all the time. I want to screw you out of your money.
But values come from someplace, which is part of what that point I was making. That's the roots.
Yeah.
I mean, if I value blowing you up so I can go to heaven with 72 or whatever virgins, I mean, that value comes from a faith system. Mm-hmm. So it's the faith system from which everything is flowing. One way. Mm-hmm.
But if you're atheist, you may not feel that way. But that doesn't mean they don't have a moral set.
Well, I recall book titled, I Don't Believe in Atheists.
But I know atheists who would disagree with you. Some of them live there.
So that kind of, does the presentation make sense so far? Where the externalities make it out of sight, out of mind,
right.
And the dualisms make it out of mind, out of body. Mm-hmm. And so it's a pretty...
I worked
on that for a while.
You made the connection.
It's a pretty easy transition into that. They just don't take the time to consider to make the invisible visible. And that's the root cause of what we're in right now. A root cause that we're in right now.
Well, when you're God, nothing else matters. I'm number one. I don't have to worry about that. And that's why I say it's a spiritual problem. It's that first statement. You know, bite the apple, you'll be like God. Here we are back in the Garden of Eden, right? What'd they do after they bit the apple? They covered themselves. God's walking by the story we live by. You know, who told you you're naked? Suddenly it's ears. Self-consciousness.
So I think that part of this presentation too is to figure out more perspectives on how to have these conversations. Because when I go home, or go back to seminary. A lot of it is the peace faith kind of conversations. But we live in New York, a mile and a half from Wall Street. You go down the street, and you can't start off with a faith conversation.
No, of course not.
So I think that's part of what we're doing here.
I'm just thinking about externalities out of sight, out of mind, dualisms out of mind, out of body, and the complexity of how that may be true in some cases, but for, say, environmental racism, it's becoming out of mind into someone else's body.
Yeah.
So like the water in Flint, maybe that's someone's, you know, out of sight, out of mind, out of body. And then we have bodies, so many bodies being affected by these externalities.
Yeah.
And I think
go ahead.
I think how many of us in the past, I don't care, week even, maybe 24 hours, haven't had the thought, how can that person believe what they believe, think what they think, because it is so harmful to the community as a whole. And I'm heading into the political realm, and Carl kind of took us there earlier. But I think of a conversation that I had at the dinner table where a total stranger is engaged in conversation, and all of a sudden there is a revelation of their beliefs about what will save this country. And the answer that they have is Donald Trump. How do you have that conversation? How does it begin when all you can do is open your, you know, and you don't even know how we can begin the conversation that can bring us back to a community that has similar goals? Wow.
Well, it's understanding that we beings are emotive and intuitive creatures first. We are not rational. I mean, he's not a rational man, and that his community is not reacting to him rationally. It is an irrational thing. Who doesn't yearn for something or other? And when he plugs into the, just as advertisers do, they plug into the emotive, intuitive thing, that's what people hear. That's what entertainment is about. That's what, so you can't talk ration with that. It's not a rational thing.
And the rain at the time.
That's fine.
That's awesome. I can certainly keep having a conversation.
Well, just to play devil's advocate, if I'm a Trump supporter, I do think I'm being rational and rationally voting for the person who holds my set of values and beliefs. Mm-hmm. And if I were trying to have a conversation with you, Lori, and said, and you said you're being irrational, boom, like, there's no bridge anymore. Mm-hmm. And thinking, trying to sort of loop it back into this, how do you talk about these things in North Dakota or at Holden Village, knowing that, you know, clearly there's so many passionate hearts here and elsewhere.
And what are we externalizing on each other, mm-hmm. even by having this conversation? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, because I come from more of a psychology, like, and when I hear this on this external level, it immediately brings me into, like, this is what we do as human beings. Like, we do this with our emotions, we do this with our beliefs, like, we go around operating in our world thinking what we're thinking, and, like, you know, I mean, and as my own, just thinking of myself, like, in what we're saying about values, like, isn't it our beliefs about ourself in the world that, you know, that move us to act in the way that we do, and how, I mean, how it's happening on this micro level, like, we're acting in the world. We don't know how every action that we take or what we say, how that hurts another person or lifts them up, or, you know, I mean, and so it makes sense that then as a global community, we act in these really big ways, and it's very hard to see every, but yeah, just I like going out there and then coming back in and being like, well, don't we kind of do that to each other? Like, and maybe if we were, if we understood it, because I also can start to feel guilty, like, oh, I drove here, I just came on the bus, I just went on the thing, like, I, you know, there's so
food.
Many ways. Yeah, I eat food, take showers, like.
Use water?
Right, so, I mean, and like, yeah, I have hard days, and sometimes I don't communicate as kindly as I could to people, or, you know, mm-hmm. So it's like, yeah, I mean, that conversation is just in, as much internal, I think, as it is external, and that we need healing in both areas to really find a solution that, mm-hmm. yeah.
And I think that maybe everyone's feeling a little downtrodden right now, because it's every interaction, right? Just, everything I externalize, and I could do it, do something better and have fewer externalities. And this week, I'm gonna pull you and push you and pull you and push you. And this today is a little bit depressing. And tomorrow, as we get into a little bit of Bonhoeffer, it's maybe going to be a little bit uplifting. And then I'm going to bring you back down. And we're gonna, on Wednesday, we're going to look at some environmental cases that I helped write. And then I'm going to push you back out on Thursday with a little bit of how Bonhoeffer can help us look at these issues. So if you're thinking, man, that sucked, come back tomorrow and we'll have a little bit more hope for you. Because Bonhoeffer's whole thing is how you see yourself as an individual, as you relate to someone else, how that forms a community. Because at least for Bonhoeffer, you become a human. You become yourself when you have this self-conscious other, and we other people all the time in a very negative, externalizing way. But Bonhoeffer means to bring the other into the self and realize that the other person is a self as you are a self. So we're talking a bit more about how that all plays out tomorrow, where Christ comes into that. And if you want to read about it, I have four things that I printed off from his dissertation called Sanctorum Communion of Saints. It's, I believe, like 20 pages. And then also a little bit of Bonhoeffer's context, because he was born in 1906, right before World War I, and grew up between World War I and World War II. One of his older brothers died in World War I, so it really influenced him. And this is a radio address. I have two copies right here. That he describes what it was like growing up between World War I and World War II. Yeah. Really, kind of, because he's not a common day German. This is upper middle class. We'll get into that. Yeah. But so if you want to read a little bit for tomorrow, not required whatsoever. As you can kind of hopefully get from today, you don't have to read to be part of the conversation. But you might have a little bit. Your questions might be different tomorrow. And if you're a little curious, I have one copy of my syllabus tomorrow, or one copy of my syllabus here. And if you want to read Lynn White's stuff about dualisms and how they're perpetuated and Western Christianity, I have two copies right here. And I'm around if you want to continue kind of talking about this. This is what Holden is. Might as well see you at dinner.